Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Petra Edwards. Petra is a dog trainer in Adelaide, South Australia, and has a Bachelor of Science in Honours with a specialisation in animal behaviour. She also holds the Professional Canine Trainer Accreditation through the Pet Professional Accreditation Board. Petra is currently studying her PhD, investigating how dogs experience their veterinary visits. She hopes her research will not only shed light on the veterinary experience, but offer practical and achievable solutions for improving welfare in the veterinary context. Petra has been involved in the dog training industry from a young age and has worked extensively over the years as an assistant and instructor of pet dog training classes and puppy preschools. She is fascinated by all things behavior and especially loves helping owners and dogs live happily and companionably through positive reinforcement. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Petra Edwards to the ATA podcast show today. She's patiently waiting by. Petra, good morning to you.
Morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Now, I think companionably is a new word for me. Did I say that? How do you say
companionably?
Companionably.
It sounded good when I was writing it late last night. But
I like it too. I'm going to see if I can. I've got to learn how to say it first, but then see if I can start.
Something that you can read easier than you can say.
And we have been connected for our great friend, Nicholas Bishop, who can listen to a previous ATA podcast show way back near the beginning of the show's history. But we share that great mutual friend. So really excited to finally connect with you today, Petra, because I have heard so many good things about you.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm excited too. A little bit nervous, but very excited. And thanks, Nick, for putting us in touch.
Nerves are good, I think. But we're going to get you patient. That is the aim. So let's dive into the first question today, Petra. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first got started, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share some stories about some of the first animals you trained using it?
No worries. So I first got into the dog training industry when I was 12. My mum graduated the Delta dog training qualification here in Australia and started a business called Adelaide Pet Dog Training. I was a bit of a brat when I was a kid, and she actually didn't want me to participate in her brand new business venture, which I get looking back in hindsight. But on the very first morning of her very first class of paying clients, I got in the car when she wasn't looking and just refused to get out until she was going to be late and she had to take me with her. So that was a fun start, but I absolutely loved it. And it actually really was a wonderful relationship building sort of experience for me to go and watch my mum be an amazing trainer and to learn from her. But also I absolutely loved watching people achieve goals with their dogs and watching behaviour change happen so quickly. I was really quite amazed at how quickly you can teach a sit as a 12-year-old kid and how much success you could get so quickly in a very short space of time. So I was kind of caught from then. I had the hook sunk in, and from there, I was lucky enough to be able to listen to lots of different instructors. As my mum's business grew, I stopped listening just to her. I never listened to her, but I stopped listening just to her and learning from her solely, and was able to learn from the other instructors that she hired. So, and developed some really lovely close relationships with other qualified trainers that have been my friends and mentors since then. So they've really known me as a kid and have just kind of supported me all through this amazing journey that I've had, which I'm so grateful for. So thank you, Bev and Deb and Beau, Suzanne and Alexis, if you're listening. I really appreciate all your support and guidance over the years. When I was a kid, I knew nothing, and I started just holding a lead when my mum would tell me to shut up and hold a lead to help someone. And then over time was able to just kind of, as I learned more, step in and be more of an assistant and kind of just help keep dogs quiet while my mum was teaching classes, and then move on from there. And I just really, really, really loved the success and interactions I observed in that time and kind of the learning process, which was great. And I went to my first conference a few years later with Dumba, and that was absolutely amazing. And from then I decided that I wanted to speak and teach and have this as part of my future career. So I, when I finished high school, I started my undergraduate degree in a Bachelor of Science with a specialization in animal behavior. I did that part-time and loved it, and then wanted to specialise a little bit more. So I did an honours degree in animal science, looking at the different types of equipment that we use on our dogs and on pet dogs specifically. And then from there, I decided to do a PhD. And so my PhD focuses on how dogs experience their veterinary visits, and I am just about to enter my final year. And the second part of the question was some of the first animals that I've trained. Yeah. So I guess the first animal that I trained was my parents, human animals, as Nick calls them. I think I did really well sometimes and I failed miserably other times, but I'm sure I obviously don't remember necessarily thinking about applying the positive reinforcement principles in that regard, but I was very lucky that my parents had very much a positive reinforcement approach to my upbringing, and I was involved in a lot of my behavioural outcomes. So apart from, you know, doing chores for money and things like that, one of the things that we had in our house was I was able to negotiate how much good behaviour I had to do in order to get a new toy that I wanted as a kid. And so I guess the reinforcer for them was my good behaviour, and the reinforcer for me was the toy. And I have this vivid memory of me sitting down with my mum and negotiating how many weeks of good behaviour I needed to have in order to get this brand new Barbie horse that came out, which was very exciting because it moved on its own. It could walk. So I was very, very invested in getting that horse. And I think it was like 5 weeks. I had to not talk back at her for 5 weeks in a row for me to get the horse. And I got it, and I still have it. So that was a very lasting experience for me. And then that was kind of the theme growing up, as in terms of how we went about negotiating things that I wanted. If I wanted to take time off school or anything like that, it was just a discussion that we had, and we could negotiate and be honest from there. So that was really cool. The first dog that I trained was my childhood dog, Kelly, growing up. She was an Australian cattle dog cross small terrier, but she kind of just, she looked like a wombat. So she had, you know, a really broad nose and a wide head and small ears and a barrel body and very short legs, and she waddled everywhere. And so we just kind of called her the wombat. And I took her to dog training classes at the local dog school. And I think it was more because my mum wanted me out of her hair than actually wanted me to learn about training. And the clubs were traditional, so we had to use a choke chain and all of that sort of stuff. But Kelly was already quite well trained by then, so I don't remember necessarily correcting her, although I'm sure it must have happened at some point. But one of the things that I remember from that was the instructor. I was always the youngest kid in the class, always the only kid in the class. And the instructor kind of pulled me aside one day and said that I was doing really, really well, because I'd always felt kind of out of my depth, because I was a young kid in a group of adults, and it was quite hard for me to feel like I could do what they could do. And he pulled me aside one day and said that I was doing a great job because I was holding my hands in the right position, which was just in front of my belly, like just, you know, I was just copying all the other adults. But he pointed me out and said that I was doing great. And that was my first experience in a formal capacity with constructive positive feedback. And obviously it stuck with me. And I absolutely, it just made me feel really amazing as a young kid to be noticed and to be acknowledged. So it's something that I, whenever I remember, I try and incorporate into my classes as much as possible. Not just, hey, you're doing great, your dog's progressed so much, but be very constructive about why they're doing great. Find something that you can pick up on and say, you know, this is fantastic because you fed in this position and that means the dog's not going to jump up. So you've really, really worked hard on this, I can tell. Or, you know, whatever it might be. So that was, I guess, the first actual animal that I worked with, and obviously transitioned into positive reinforcement from there. We had a Great Dane growing up as well, which is he was 80 kilos and I was 50 kilos as a kid. So that was always fun walking him and learning how to use positive reinforcement with a dog that just could literally pull me over. And it just worked obviously so well, as we know it does. In terms of and my delivery of treats was really easy because we were the same height, and so that was a lot of fun. Walking this 80 kilo Great Dane down the street, and with my parents behind me, but I felt like I had control over the lead, and just kind of watching everyone get out my way and feeling very powerful about it. So that was really cool too.
So a couple of defining moments, I would say, in your story there.
Yeah, those are the ones that kind of that stand out. There were many really cool sort of experiences. I think as a kid I really loved being included in the adult group that I was in, because obviously in terms of learning from and listening to the instructors that my mum had hired, and being included in that group as if I was an adult, certainly made me feel very mature and very successful, whatever that looks like as a kid. So I really valued that and those relationships that I developed early on as well.
And so you called yourself a Brett, pre-12-year-old. So operationalize it for us.
Right. So Brat looks like, a young Petra Brat looks like someone that talks back to her parents, clearly knows what's best for her and what that looks like, and knows everything there is to know about the world, which I wish I had that confidence now. She would be left to be babysat by her older sister, and then climb the roof, and my sister couldn't grab me. So my parents would come home and I would be waving at them from the roof of the house, which I always thought was hilarious, but clearly they did not. Things like having disagreements with my mum and then threatening to run away, and then going through the lovely sort of conversation of her saying, all right, well, I'll call you a cab, here's the door, and then us going, okay, well, clearly I'm calling you a bluff and you're calling mine, so let's go back inside and watch TV. What else did I do? Would forget to come home from school, so I'd just kind of walk. Our school was very, very close by, but I'd walk home in a little creek and just get distracted playing with rocks and things like that, and then my mum would have to come out and find me an hour later. This is, you know, when I was 10 or something like that. So just very confident in myself and what I can do and my abilities, and very opinionated about how that should happen and how those interactions should occur with the world, I guess.
And then at 12 years old, because of your brattiness, you decided to jump in the car. You headed to your mum's dog training class, which was all positive reinforcement at that time?
It was, yeah.
And you got hooked there, you said.
Yeah.
And you went through school, and then you said you attended an Ian Dunbar conference, was it?
Mm, yeah.
And so what was it about this particular conference? That was just your first one, or did that kind of, was that a game changer?
Yeah, it was a game changer. It was my very first conference that I'd ever been to, and I was very young. I can't remember exactly how old I was, maybe 14 or something. 13 or 14. I was very young. I honestly can't even remember what the conference was about or what he discussed, other than he was obviously a very engaging, very inspiring speaker. And he just gave me lots of information that I didn't know, that filled my head up. And so I just really loved that. And I came away feeling very inspired and newly confident that I knew all of the things, of course, now. And I kind of got a little bit addicted from there in terms of attending conferences, just because. And again, I think for me as a kid, it was also being a part of the adult group I really loved. I loved being included, and people would ask me questions and say how cool I was that I was a kid that was, you know, kind of participating in this adult world. And it made me feel very mature and very special, I guess, looking back. But at the time I thought I was, you know, the bee's knees. Of course, I was very cool.
So you were the bee's knees. You left home with a bunch of skills about how to kind of negotiate what you wanted via your behavior.
Yeah.
And then so you started from school, you went and started your degree, and you were doing consulting at this time as well?
No, I wasn't consulting because I didn't have yet a formal qualification. I felt like I could. I felt like I knew enough, but I wanted to just be a professionalized a little bit more. So that's essentially why I did my undergraduate degree, was because I wanted something that was nationally recognized. And I kind of had in the back of my head that I wanted to have a PhD since a young kid as well, and kind of be considered that level of expert and maybe present at conferences myself, which would be really cool.
Right. So then you went through and got your honors.
Yep.
And then you started. When did your kind of business side and working with clients and dogs?
Yeah, I did that kind of cap one and two, base level qualification, and I felt a little bit more confident that I could start kind of saying that I have some knowledge and credentials behind me. So I started really slow in terms of I was running classes for a long time for Adelaide Pet Dog Training. So I was instructing classes and things like that. But in terms of running consults, I started probably 2014 or 2015, I'd say.
Mm. And then so at that stage, you wanted to continue on and do your PhD, or you were thinking about kind of taking what you'd learned so far and following in your mum's footsteps?
Yeah, I once I started my research for my honours degree, I kind of really figured out that research is where I would like to pursue as well. So I really enjoyed that process with my honours degree. I had an amazing supervisor and mentor in the academic field, Dr. Susan Hazel, who I just really love working with. She's been so supportive of me and patient with me. So and I really kind of wanted to investigate this. There's lots of things that I wanted to investigate, but this area of dogs, fear-free vet and low stress handling and all of that sort of stuff in dogs was something that I was really interested in. So I just applied for the scholarship and for my PhD, and I decided if I wasn't going to get a scholarship, I wouldn't do one. So a scholarship is where they pay you to do the study and they cover your fees, so I wouldn't add to my HECS debt, and I wouldn't have to work while I was doing that. And if I did get a scholarship, then I would do it. So, and I got the scholarship, which was wonderful. So I'm now 2/3 of my way through.
Cool. Well, congratulations on your scholarship and being 2/3 of your way through. And we're gonna talk about your PhD and your experience on your academic journey in a little bit. But
yeah,
we've kind of been slowly edging towards this part of your story, because you and I talked about when we caught up last week that you were going to, well, we're grateful that you're going to be brave and share with us some of the stuff that went on during that time for you, because you,
Yeah.
You started going down the consult and client route. And can you share with us a little bit of your journey there? And, you know, we talked about your, I'm going to call it a barter system in your home for getting Barbie ponies. And you figured out this way to navigate. And you mentioned this, you know, something that sticks out in your memory of this constructive feedback you got. And now you've finished school, you've got your qualification that you're seeking, you're doing it, you're living and breathing it. Did it meet your expectations? Was it exceeding your expectations? What happened at this time?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So I started advertising that I was going to offer consults, and I'm lucky, I do have a wonderful network in Adelaide. So I started picking up consults quite quickly. I was still studying at the time, so I was trying to be careful not to take on too many. But when you're starting a new business, you tend to take on whatever people will pay you for. So I would, I was terrified that this would be the last opportunity that I'd have to run a consult. So I ended up taking on too many, I think. And I was offering consults, you know, Saturday, Sunday afternoons and during the night, as most people do, as most dog trainers do, and felt very successful. I was getting good feedback from my clients. I always hated the money side of things. Like, I liked obviously getting money, but I hated having to ask for it. I hated the invoice side of things. It just felt, I just felt uncomfortable asking for money for a service that I love. You know, I love that sort of going in and kind of nutting it out and working out what the cause of the problem behavior was, because it was most often a problem behavior that I was called in for, and not necessarily something that might be easy, like, you know, I guess all of them are technically problem behaviors, things like jumping up on people. But often it was things like resource guarding and reactivity, as well as, you know, fear around young children and all of that sort of stuff that I was called in for. And I really enjoyed it. I loved going in, and kind of the behavior geek in me was really fascinated by the whole kind of working out the consequences, why the dog was doing the behavior, the function of that behavior, and then working out how we could make changes to that behavior or provide that behavior a different outlet. So maintain the function of the behavior without, you know, it affecting the dog's relationship with the parents. And really loved that sort of individualistic approach. And I really especially love the challenge of suggesting changes to people's lifestyles that would be successful, because obviously you have the ideal change in terms of antecedents. So, you know, let's put up barriers, let's take the dog for extra walks, let's increase its enrichment, let's do X, Y, and Z. And then the people look at you with a blank face because they actually don't want to change their behavior to change their dog's behavior. So I really loved kind of working out what would be, you know, the least they could do that would be the most effective in changing behavior, and kind of enjoyed that challenge as well, and really working with the people and developing that relationship with the people. And then I started to and then I had this amazing, in hindsight, not amazing, it sucked, experience with compassion fatigue, which I know what it is now, and I didn't at the time, I was just getting more and more slack, I guess, which is just so embarrassing to say as a professional, because you want to be acknowledged and you want to be a professional, and I just was not being the business professional person that I wanted to be, and I knew that I could be. I stopped returning calls, or it would take me a long time to return calls. I would be late to consults, and my relationship with time management, for anyone that doesn't know me, is absolutely abysmal. I have always sucked at time management, but I always cared about it, and I became quite apathetic about being late to things. I would cancel last minute on my clients because I just didn't have the mental energy to go. Or if I did go, I'd sit in the car outside their house or just down the street, and just kind of take ages to mentally prepare for going in to meet these people for a case that I had experience in and I kind of knew about it. And I knew that once I was in there, I was going to be okay, but just taking the time, I needed to take the time, the mental, to kind of fortify, I guess, build up my mental reserves before I walked into a strange person's home, which is kind of weird when you think about it. So I was kind of going through this thing where I was like, this isn't who I want to be, what's going on, but I didn't know what was going on and how to change it. And then I started my PhD in early 2017, and I'm lucky enough that one of my supervisors, Dr. Michelle MacArthur, does a lot of research in compassion fatigue and resilience and communications training in the vet students at my university. And she kind of had this lunchtime compassion fatigue seminar for anyone that was interested. And I went, and it kind of really resonated with me. And then I hired her to present the same seminar to dog trainers in Adelaide. And we kind of went through everything in a little bit more detail. And I guess she kind of discussed a lot of the symptoms, and she discussed the symptoms of compassion fatigue and sort of the things and what it was. And for anyone that doesn't know, it's kind of, I kind of liken it to a workplace depression. So it's, I think it's an OHS risk for people in caring roles. So that's us as dog trainers or people that care for animals, people that care, you know, pet owners, they obviously you care for your pet, but also people caring for people. It's high risk in lots of industries, and it's just this idea that you have X amount of, and this is my lay understanding of it, X amount of emotional empathy and capacity to care. And when you give too much of that away, you're left very drained at the end of the day, and it's very hard. Compassion fatigue is on a sliding scale, so it's not that you have it or you don't have it, it's where you are on the scale. So you can have low compassion fatigue or high compassion fatigue, and that can change as you go through your professional career and your professional life. And you are more resilient, you develop self-care techniques to move down the compassion fatigue scale, and if you lose track of those techniques, or something really bad happens in your workplace, or that might be a bit traumatic, or lots of things happen in quick succession, then you might move up the compassion fatigue scale. So after this seminar that Michelle presented to us, I kind of realized that I was high on the compassion fatigue scale. And those things that I had been struggling with that really made me feel like a fraud, I guess. I mean, we all have imposter syndrome, I'm sure. I hope we do. I hope I'm normal. And I felt definitely like a fraud, that I was really not being the person I wanted to be in this sort of professional capacity. And the more I tried to be a professional person in this consult dog training world, the more exhausted I got. Like, I was absolutely drained at the end of a 2-hour consult, because I was so focused on presenting this version of self that at that time did not resonate with my actual self. So I guess it's almost a dissonance, a cognitive dissonance as well in that regard too. Some of the symptoms that I had, looking back in hindsight, I didn't know that they were symptoms at the time of compassion fatigue, but I had a lot of tension, headaches and migraines. And as I said, I was really exhausted. I had a very short attention span, so I'd kind of go around my studies like a squirrel on Red Bull and just jump from one thing to another and get distracted by literally anything at all. And it would be like 2 hours later and I'd be like, what's going on? I was meant to be doing studying all day today and I haven't done anything. Sitting in the car to mentally prepare, being late and being apathetic about it, and taking consults when I didn't want to as well. So I, you know, had spent since I was 12, working Sundays and doing lots of night stuff for puppy preschools and classes. And then I'd have one night spare a week and I'd take a consult on that night because I was worried that if I didn't do it, the dog would go elsewhere, or the dog wouldn't get the help it needed, or I wouldn't get the business and I wanted to run a business. So I'd end up doing that, and then I'd be absolutely shattered at the end of the day. That was actually a symptom of my compassion fatigue. The way that I experienced it was this idea that, no, I need to take that consult, and this sort of over being too responsible for everyone's welfare, I guess, in the broad sense of the word. I'd also feel very like I'd take it really personally if I gave people advice and they didn't follow it. Which I think that was another kind of symptom as well at the time. So I, you know, people would ask me my advice, they'd pay me for my advice and my recommendation, and then they wouldn't follow through. And then I'd feel quite anxious about that whole process and whether I was any good at what I was doing, and why weren't they following my advice if I am a good dog trainer, and kind of take on much more of that than I needed to at the time. And then, as I said, I was really struggling to return calls, really desperately struggling to return client reports on time, which is just so horrific. But that was just the reality of what it was for me, which is weird because I don't mind writing, and I really liked kind of sitting back and analysing what was going on and sending it through. I didn't not enjoy the process, but I just didn't do the process. So just like extreme procrastination on that front as well. So that was kind of one of the things that Michelle, which I found was just absolutely life-changing, and I hope that sharing it might be beneficial for others too. But one of the things that Michelle asked us to do at this mini seminar she ran for us was write down a list of all of the roles that we have, all of the caring roles that we have as a dog trainer and, you know, family member and partner and brother and sister and pet owner. So for me at the time, it was, you know, my family, my partner Chris, my dogs, and then I had, you know, my business, my training classes, and I had written down the consults. And there might have been a few other things in there too. And then write down next to that list, each of those items, the amount of emotional energy that you spend thinking about them in an average week. And so it's the energy when you're with them, so like the amount of time that you spend with them, I guess, but also the amount of energy you spend thinking about them when you're not there. So I kind of wrote that down as percentages, and found that I would spend, you know, 10 or I can't even remember what it was now, something abysmal, like 10% of my time thinking about my partner and 20% of my time thinking about my dogs. And most of that was feeling guilty about how awful I was as a dog mum. And then like 60% of my time worrying about my consults. And so, and that was very disproportionate. I was running a few consults a week because I was still studying, but spending so much of my time stressing about them and feeling guilty for not doing the reports and worrying about that call that I hadn't returned, and as well as the actual time spent with the person. And it just kind of really highlighted to me where my stress was coming from and where these feelings were coming from. And so I made the decision to stop offering consults, because it just wasn't healthy for me at that time to maintain that. And I was lucky that I had just started my PhD and did have some income coming in through that scholarship. So I was able to make that choice, and my partner Chris is so incredibly supportive of me that it wasn't detrimental in that regard either. So we've just been kind of muddling through, but I have to say that was probably one of the best things that I did at the time, was just to make that decision to stop it, because it wasn't healthy. And when I made the decision and I changed my phone, you know, record message to, you know, hi, this is Petra, you can find me on my website, I'm not taking consults at this time, and the number of calls coming through just dropped dramatically. It was just this weight had lifted off my shoulders, and it was just the most amazing experience. It was very life-changing for me. It was a big turning point in my career, and I was sad because I really wanted to be that person that could offer consults, and it doesn't mean that I can't in the future, but I'd have to really be careful about how I structure that now, I think, once I finish my PhD.
So were you like, when you say sad, like were you grieving for who you wanted to be, and or your expectation of who you wanted to be and what life was actually showing?
Yeah, that is such a good way to describe it. I had to go through this mourning period of realizing that I wasn't the person that could do all the things all the time. That was a big part of my self-identity, especially growing up. Especially, I think, having that experience as a kid where I could negotiate outcomes for my benefit with my parents. And that was kind of something that has stuck with me throughout life, is just kind of going, well, hey, you know, just asking the question, what about if I do this? Can this work in this regard? And so not being able to have a solution and still have all the and wanting to do all the things but not being able to find a solution to do them was very difficult for me personally. But I also was sad because consults are where people learn a lot about behaviour. So you get some really unique cases. You get to develop one-on-one relationships with the clients. They're great for income, obviously, but I just had to not do that right then.
So I feel that people listening to this podcast episode are going to be thinking about some of what I think you've been calling symptoms of compassion fatigue. So they're going to be outward behaviours and potentially inward behaviours, thoughts, feelings, that are somewhere on the spectrum. I'm going to use the word spectrum, but you used a different word, the continuum,
scale.
And so I'm sitting here personally listening, as I did in the last compassion fatigue episode we did, going, oh my God, self-diagnosing.
That's me.
and I feel like a lot of the listeners of this show are going to be doing the same thing.
I mean, I can't, there are lots and lots of symptoms of compassion fatigue that are very close to depression as well, I think, as my lay understanding has it. That, you know, like, I don't think it's one of those things where you go, oh, I'm exhausted after a consult, I must have compassion fatigue. But I think if you are noticing that you have several, and like this is just my experience as well, so we need to clarify that my experience is going to be different to everyone else's, but hopefully similar in some regards too, and I'm not alone. But I think the more you tick off that list, the higher chances you have, is my understanding of it. And I think it does, there are some inward behaviours there. I think you need to kind of just be really self-reflective about how your thoughts and your feelings are. You know, like if you get another phone call about someone and you go, oh, you know, shit, I've got to do that, instead of, oh, great, this is a fantastic opportunity, I'd love to learn more, then that might be kind of a little bit of a red flag. And just have a think about how many red flags you have adding up over a week, and then go from there. But I do think it's one of those things that, I mean, as I said, we're all on the scale somewhere. And it's not necessarily about not having compassion fatigue. It's just being aware that there's a risk of it in our industry, and being aware that you can move up the scale. So one of the things that has been really beneficial for me is just focusing on my self-care and making sure that I have that structure in place to build on my resilience, because the more resilient you are, the lower on the scale you might be, or the less chance you're going to slide up the scale, at least. So I try not to book in too many things at once. I try really hard to make sure that I've done some exercise and I go for a run and I eat healthy as often as I can in the week. And I'm not a great cook, so that is very hard for me, and that takes up a lot of my emotional energy to think about what to cook and how to cook it and to spend time in the kitchen doing it. It's very draining, but I always feel better afterwards, so I try really hard to do that. Mindfulness has been wonderful for me in terms of helping my resilience and just being aware of my thoughts and feelings and practicing being present. So anyone that hasn't heard of mindfulness, it's kind of, a precursor to meditation, or a complementary therapy to meditation and yoga. But it's just this practice of kind of being in the moment, because anxieties tend to make your mind jump into the future and worrying about the future. So it's really beneficial just to kind of take a step back and notice sights and sounds and colours and how your body is feeling emotionally, but also physically. Where are you aching? And just being a bit more in tune with yourself. And that self-reflection has been really beneficial for me in helping me track how I'm moving up and down the compassion fatigue scale as we kind of move forward. And I think that, you know, if people want to do consults, because I think that's a really important part of what we offer, just being that there are ways that I can see I could do them moving forward that don't involve as much phone time, or have a bit, you know, more automated processes in place to help me with that side of things. So it's just a matter of going in and doing the consult and coming out, which I think would be much easier than the whole precursor. I really struggled with the phone conversations, spending time on the phone, as well as returning people's calls. That was a big, irrational looking back, but it was that was a big factor for me, and it took up a lot of my emotional energy kind of thinking about how to do that. So if there was a way that I could structure my website or my business around not having to do that as much, that would be really beneficial, and I think make consults much more viable for me in the future. But in all honesty, I haven't looked back because I really enjoy my weekends and my nights. It's really nice to spend time with my partner. So
yeah, and we did a podcast recently with Gene Donaldson, who suggested that we have hobbies outside of what we do.
Yeah, right. Because we're so so passionate about behaviour and helping and bettering, you know, the lives of the animals that we work with, that it's really hard to take that step back. But for me, that was a big red flag. It was like, if I don't do this, who will? If I don't help this dog, who will? And that was actually a negative for me. That was not useful because I was taking on much more than I could actually do safely. So, and when I say safely, I mean it had a big impact on my mental health to take on more than I could. So I ended up, I felt great after I stopped my consults, but I don't think I stopped them soon enough. So I ended up now going through a process of also anxiety and I think depression that I am. My compassion fatigue is much more stable, but I'm now working through that side of things too, because I think it bled out into my life, the other aspects of my life, and it didn't stay just within my career. So I worry, I don't know if worry is the right word. I wonder how connected they are, and I worry that other trainers might have those symptoms and be where I was, where this isn't quite right. I don't really know what's going on. Why am I behaving this way? I don't really understand why I'm not being the business professional person that I want to be. And, you know, not realize that there might be a compassion fatigue component surrounding that. And so what happened to me was I stopped my consults earlier in 2017, was kind of pushing through and doing okay. I felt better, but I wasn't actually better. I think my behavior said otherwise. I still wasn't being productive in my PhD. I still was cancelling. I still was being late, but I felt like this weight had lifted off my shoulders. And I went to the APDT conference, which was absolutely amazing, in Adelaide, in my hometown, which is really rare. We don't get big conferences in Adelaide very often. And I absolutely loved it. But then I crashed really, really hard after that and spent almost a month not wanting to leave the house, and then had to go through the process of being diagnosed with anxiety and that sort of side of things, and seeing a psychologist, and had to take time off my PhD to get my mental health back on track. And I will never know, but I wonder if I had noticed sooner whether that outcome might have been different.
Yeah, and once again, I think there's people listening that potentially might be wondering similar things. I feel I'm feeling grateful to you for sharing.
Thank you.
I think it's a little bit confronting, to be honest with you, because you mentioned a little bit earlier about looking out for red flags, and in order to open up this conversation for others, I'll make myself vulnerable here. Like I'm listening to you talking, and I'm looking at my own life, and I'm seeing red flags. You know.
Yeah, yeah. It's really scary, because I think the trouble is that being the behavior geek, being this person that is passionate about behavior and passionate about welfare and passionate about building better relationships with our clients and their animals, and between our clients and their animals, so that everyone can live companionably and safe together and happily together, and being the voice for the animal, which I think is a big one for us, was a big part of my self-identity. Like I don't actually know what I am outside of that, you know? And I think, I'm sure a lot of people are very similar. They've been caught by the behavior bug just like me. And so it was really hard. And one of the things that I really struggled with was, especially with the social anxiety that I have, is talking to people. And so thank you for making this such an easy experience for me. But also things like the mass of social interaction at conferences, which is really sucky, because I really love conferences, and I really love learning, and I really love being inspired by them, and I really want to present at them. But it is actually, so that's kind of where I want to be in my future. But I crash really hard afterwards if I don't take care of myself well. And I don't know what that balance is yet. I haven't found it yet. It's a work in progress. So that's been really hard because my psychologist has mentioned a few times, well, maybe let's have a look at what you could do that doesn't involve presenting at conferences. But that's been a big part of where I want to go in my future for a long, long time. So trying to reconcile with that has been quite difficult. And I'm not there yet. I'm still convinced that I can make changes to make it successful and viable in the future. But I do think that you're right in terms of there is a grieving process, like you were saying before. And it does make you, like, I think that the thing to remember, though, is that everyone has red flags, right? Because we're all going to be on the scale somewhere, even low. So a red flag isn't necessarily an issue, but I think they're worth tracking and just making note of, and just kind of seeing how you feel. Because one of the things that I've noticed is that in our industry, I'm sure in all industries, people always present the best front for themselves. So social media makes people look very successful and very happy doing it all the time. And I'm sure that that's not the case behind the scenes. We all have breakdowns and we all have stresses. So it's really hard, I think, to compare how you want to be successful with how other people show their success and kind of reconcile the two as if they're equally viable. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, your success is going to be different to someone else's, and trying to measure how you are succeeding in comparison to what other people are showing on their social media is going to be very hard. There's going to be a lot of shortfall there, I think, sometimes.
Hey, so I'm going to say thank you again for sharing. I'm going to do a quick recap of everything you've just said. And
please.
So you described yourself like a squirrel on a Red Bull.
Yeah.
Like I said, thank you for being brave. And you said that you were starting to notice some things, like you're becoming slack, you stopped returning calls, it took you a long time to return calls, you'd be late to consults, your already bad relationship with time management got even worse, and you'd stop caring about being late for things, you'd cancel last minute. And it was when you saw this presentation from, remind me of the name?
Michelle MacArthur. A lecturer at Adelaide University.
So it was like someone describing and putting a label on the things you were experiencing?
Yeah, it was really weird because I was experiencing these things and just thought that they were my normal and thought that I was failing. My normal was failing until I kind of sat down and learned a bit more about, she went through all the different symptoms, and there's, you know, behavioral and psychological symptoms as well of compassion fatigue. It's not just one or the other. There's inward and outward. And so she kind of went through them, and the list is massive, and I don't have everything on the list, but I just resonated with a bunch of stuff on the list. But I think the thing for me that made me change my behavior was that list of caring roles that I had, and seeing, and just, I was just shocked and so sad that, because we all have a finite amount of emotional energy, right, in a day. And I was so sad to see that a lot of mine was going to someone that I didn't even know, you know? Like, business is important, absolutely, and your relationships with your clients are important, but I was very sad to see that I wasn't giving my partner or my dogs the same courtesy, and that the association I had with that emotional energy I was giving my clients was negative. It was always guilt. It was always, oh, shit, I haven't done that. Or, you know, I worry about this dog, or I forgot to tell them this thing, or, oh my gosh, I've got a consult on Friday morning. I don't want to go. I'm already feeling bad about it. It's already going to be a challenging one. I'm really stressed about this. And very little of it was positive in the affective sense, in the emotional sense of, I'm so excited to go. I'm really happy that I was able to help that dog. It was very negative based.
And so a word we haven't used here, but I'm curious to throw at you and see what happens is burnout.
Mm.
And so after this APDT conference in Adelaide, and of course you would go, of course you would, right?
Yeah, of Some, course.
Down the road.
Who would miss that?
What happened there?
I associate the word burnout with like a almost slow grating down of your energy reserves. That's not the right way to say it, but this sort of slow process that occurs over time. And I think I was burnt out probably all through since I started offering consults, but or becoming burnt out But after the APDT conference, I just crashed. And I don't know another way to describe it. It might be burnout scientifically, but it was this emotional draining. And I thought, I'll just take today, you know, the day after the, I'll just take today and just kind of reset and recharge. That was, you know, a big 4 days for me. I'm okay. And then the next day I'd just take today. And the next day I'll just take today. And it got to the point where I was in the house for like 4 or 5 days and I couldn't leave. Like I just couldn't leave. I didn't want to get out of bed and I didn't want to go to the shops and get food and I just couldn't be bothered. I didn't walk my dogs, didn't train my dogs. Like it was just so abnormal. And so painful because my brain was still operating. Like I know that I should be doing this. I'm okay. I should get up. I should do. And you know, you have all these thoughts and feelings about, or I did anyway, about, you know, it's not that hard. Just get out of bed. You're fine. Just, you know, what are you doing? This is, you're being absolutely ridiculous and being very unkind to yourself, which is sucky to be in your own brain and have that. So I can't describe it any other way other than just crashed, because it was just this real big emotional plummet and behavioral plummet. Like I just stopped behaving, I guess. And it took me weeks to figure out that it wasn't a phase and I had to do something about it. So I'm sure that is the culmination of burnout, but it was I guess I was lucky that I had this very sudden thing that caused me to have a really good look at my behavior, as opposed to just kind of trying to push through and hoping that it will get better.
Kind of sounds like learned helplessness.
Yeah, right. It was really quite weird to experience it. And I don't know physiologically speaking whether my, you know, adrenaline and heart rate and cortisol and all that were up high or not, or whether it was just a brain thing or what. Who knows? But it was just really weird to be present and to equally not have the energy or emotional capacity to make decisions about how to go about your life. So I think at that stage I was probably, you could label it, depressed. But I didn't realize, or didn't kind of, in hindsight, that's I guess how I would label it, but I didn't feel sad. So it was more an apathy, just an intense not caring. So I don't know whether that, yeah, so I guess that might be how I have experienced depression. If, I mean, we all experience things differently, yeah.
Hey, let's just looking at the time. Because I'm interested to just keep talking about this, but
yeah,
there's some other stuff that I thought would be really valuable to use this opportunity to have you on the show to talk with the guests about. So let's just start to head towards the end of the episode. Once again, continuing our gratitude for your bravery today and sharing with us.
Thank you.
But with this a little bit of the podcast episode, I was curious to learn a little bit more about, I'm pausing because like I'm conscious of such a sudden shift in like mood of the episode and going to talk about your PhD. Fine. But I do want to learn more because I think achieving a PhD is such a huge undertaking. And a huge amount of effort, and I'm sure there's, you know, a lot of emotional investment that goes into that project, right, as well. Mm-hmm. So you're not quite there yet. We realise that when you're doing a PhD and you're not published, you can't just openly talk about what the results are. But you were talking about some of the things you learned during this process to me when we caught up last week, and we thought you could share five quick things you've learned on your academic journey.
Okay, sure, I'd love to. From a research perspective, we just had our first paper published, which was very exciting. So my literature review, which is the first chapter of my thesis, was published in Applied Animal Behaviour Science, and then picked up by Companion Animal Psychology, the blog that Dr. Zazy Togg does, and which was so exciting. So that was a review of the literature currently, and one of the common themes that I've had in my academic journey, my academic, like I'm a professional at it, I'm just a student, I'm a little person, but I am one of the common themes I've come across since starting research was that we don't know as much as we think we know. And so when I entered this area of dog experience and low stress handling and fear-free handling, knowing that there are some amazing qualifications out there that people can get in fear-free and low stress certifications, and, you know, knowing what we know about operant conditioning and how and just the laws of learning in general, I was really shocked to see there is very little research on fear-free. Like, there's actually very little proof that behavioral strategies are effective. I'm not saying that they're not effective. I'm saying that the science hasn't shown. There's no one has done the research yet. It's just a new field in the scientific literature. And so when I was doing my lit review, I wanted to do a big summary of all the different recommendations. And just as I had kind of started writing it, another researcher in Queensland, Dr. Janice Lloyd, published one, the exact same, that like very, not exact, not the same, but she published in the area that I wanted to write about. So I can't do that because you have to contribute something new. So my literature review ended up looking at all the different ways that dog perspective might influence their stress, I guess. So kind of looking at the literature from that regard in terms of, well, what might influence a dog's experience, which is their genetic history, their previous experience at the vet clinic, the things that they can't control, like their size or their age, their sex, whether they were neutered, as well as the human interactions. So there's, you know, the vet staff and owner interactions, the vet staff and dog interaction, the interactions that the vet has with the dog and the interactions with the owner that the owner has with the dog. So there's that sort of triangle there of these all three stakeholders that are involved in the vet visit, and kind of we don't know much about how that all influences their experience and might influence their stress or impact on their stress. So that was just kind of this really interesting sort of summary of what we know about how that might exist so far. And I guess that the logical outcome is that there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all response for how dogs experience the vet visits. Their perception, which is the thing that will influence whether they're stressed or not, how they perceive what's going on, is going to be impacted by so many different things that are going to be different for so many different dogs that it's likely, my guess, and we need to do more research on it, but my guess is that there's going to be different things for different dogs that cause stress, right? Which makes sense when you think about it, especially from an ABA perspective. I'm really excited to kind of start that research more. I think one of the most beneficial things we can do, though, is just be empowered to have a chat with our vets. And if you're a vet, be empowered to have a chat with your clients about, hey, you know, I'm noticing some signs of stress here, or your dog doesn't look too comfortable, it keeps moving away. Let's brainstorm some ideas that might help that situation. And then from there, there is just this myriad of recommendations that all are very logical and make a lot of sense from a behavioral perspective that can be used to hopefully reduce stress, and hopefully the research will catch up with our recommendations and what we know is going to work in the majority of instances. So I think that would be really beneficial to just kind of start those conversations more, because you never know. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is the vet says no and you're back at square one. Like, there's not going to be any sort of anything lost in that. I think pet owners should really be encouraged to ask, and trainers can start that conversation with their local vets too. Laura Ryder, who I think was on your show recently, had an amazing recommendation. Just kind of as trainers, we can go into vets and say, hey, I can offer, if you have dogs that are scared, you know, these are some of the things that I can do that might help them, and leave some cards. Because vets don't like working with dogs that are aggressive or stressed, just like we don't like seeing them. So we might as well partner up. I think more collaboration in those between trainers and vets would be really lovely.
So maybe you don't need to answer this last question then. But I do want to hear it in your words, and I want to hear you repeat it, because, you know, we have so many takeaways that we can think about moving forward over the next 5 to 10 years. But this is something I love to get guests' input on, their vision for the future. We are in year 3 now of the podcast show, so we've got this great catalogue of people sharing their visions of the future from the beginning of the show. But what about yours? Like I said, we can probably pull out from this episode some of the things you'd like to see change, and some of the conversations specifically you'd like to see more of or started in some cases. But build on everything you've shared with us so far. What do you really want to see happen moving forward over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training behavior nerd, I'm going to say. I think it's relevant to this conversation world.
Yeah. Oh, I feel like I've got to get on my high horse. No, I am.
Do it.
I think.
Your Barbie high horse.
My Barbie high horse, yeah. I'll have to find it and send you a photo. It's horrific. I don't know why I spent 5 weeks being good for that, but anyway, that's what happened. So from a personal perspective, kind of, I would really like to see more formal learning about compassion fatigue. There are so many dog training qualifications and animal training qualifications out there now, and obviously I have not done them all. But I feel like it's an OHS risk, and so like those qualifications should talk about, you know, protective gear and closed-in shoes and protective contact and, you know, working alone if you do consults, what procedures you should have in place for your safety and things like that. I think they should also incorporate discussion on noticing the signs of your compassion fatigue sliding up that scale, but also how to make sure you can maintain your resilience, because we all enter the field, I'm sure, pardon me, with a level of resilience and enthusiasm that kind of masks everything else until we've been in the industry for a little while, and then I think that burnout does start to happen, especially I imagine when there's cases of moral distress, so things where you are in an industry, maybe like the shelter industry, for example, or the rescue industry, where you, or as a vet nurse, where you're seeing things that you don't agree with morally, but you are not necessarily in control or able to stop or change that process. And so the big one for me, I think about, is euthanasia, which can be, I have not worked in the industry, but I imagine it's a very traumatic experience to have this sort of moral distress where, and for me personally, it was when I was working on the beach. I was the beach education officer for the local government council, which was awesome. And I'd have to, my job was to make sure dogs were on lead and not hassling other people on the beach, which was wonderful in summer. But I did have conversations with people about their choke chains on their dogs. And there were times where I just had to let it go because obviously they were invested in that. And so there's a level of moral distress there where you don't agree with the outcome of the conversation, but you just have to kind of let the person do their thing. And so I think in situ, I think it's likely, compassion fatigue is likely in our industry, it's an OHS risk. And I think people that are pursuing qualifications need to know as much about how to manage a lifelong career in the industry as they need to know about learning about behavior. And so learning about behavior in many cases can be really easy, but learning about how to manage your behavior in relation to that can be quite hard. And I think it's important for people to be able to kind of be aware of those red flags as they move through. And I'm sure that there are qualifications that have that as part of it, but I think it's a conversation that needs to be happening more and more and more, so that it doesn't get as bad as it can, I guess, in that regard. One of the other things that I would really like to see from our industry and from other industries is to have this our industry behavior recognized as its own science a little bit better. And because I'm sure we've all had experience with people from other industries like vets or vet nurses or groomers or daycare workers, or, you know, any of the other people that work in the pet care industry, providing behavior advice that often can be great, but often can be something that we know might not be true or valid as other information. And I would really love to see that happen where we work better at collaborating with other industries. So they can refer to us when they have behavioral questions, or they can ask us questions about how behavior can apply better to their industry. Because we know that their behavior obviously applies to everything. But you know, where we don't give medical advice, it would be really lovely to have vets that learn more about behavior, for example, or refer to us if they don't want to learn more about behavior, which is totally respectable because they have so much else that they need to be on top of. And I think for that to happen, us as trainers need to be really aware of the advice that we give, because we can also be very good at giving advice in fields that we are not experienced or qualified in. And so I think it's great to say get a second opinion, but I don't think it's necessarily great for trainers that don't have veterinary or vet nursing backgrounds or grooming backgrounds or whatever to be providing that advice to. I think the respect needs to go both ways. Yeah.
More conversations, more collaborations.
Yeah, right. Just that whole sort of ethos of being kind and respectful and offering a judgment-free zone to at least start those conversations, I think is really important. Because positive reinforcement trainers can be, we're amazing, but we can also be very quite judgmental in our pursuit of trying to get our point across sometimes. And I think it puts people off more than helps people want to change their behaviour.
Well, thank you for modelling. Thank you for, as our friend Nick Bishop reminds us, being the change that you want to see in the world. I think that applies to your offerings and sharing today in this podcast episode. So thank you very much. That sadly was our last question. Before we wrap up, If you would like an opportunity, then now's your time to tell people listening to the show where they can go to get in contact with you, find out more, see your website, social media.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a website which is just my name. It's super original. So www.petraedwards.com. Don't judge me. So that is where you can go to learn more about kind of what I'm doing in my background and where I'm at with those things. But my business is kind of on hold at the moment while I finalise my PhD. I had to, in my pursuit of better mental health, my productivity in my PhD suffered for the first year and a bit. So I have a lot of catching up to do this final year. I do have a Facebook page as well, which is just Petra Edwards Companion Animal Behaviour Consultant, which is a very fancy way of saying dog trainer. I don't know why I didn't just say dog trainer when I started it, but that's what it is now. And so you can hear more about and see more about what I do on that page as well. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Ryan, to share my story.
Absolutely. We're going to link to all of that in the show notes as well. Thank you for sharing your story. I don't know if it's appropriate to say, Petra, but I'm going to say this has been fun.
Thank you. No, it has been. I think it's cool to talk about it, you know, like people, I think more people should talk about it.
I agree. And hopefully, you know, if you're listening and you need to talk about it, then I'm going to put this on the ATA Facebook page. That's obviously a very public place, but you can message Animal Training Academy through there and you can message Petra through her Facebook page. But please, if you feel like you need to talk, then reach out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, we're going to head to the final little paragraph on my show notes here before we wrap up. So once again, for your bravery and for being you, thank you for being you and thank you for sharing with us today, Petra. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for making it as easy as it could be.
Hey, everyone listening out there, we really appreciate you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, stress-free for us, joyous-rich ways with mindfulness, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as breakfast time with 1,000 different behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.